Chapter 6. Robin had waited 10 minutes to make sure that Strike was not about to come back before making several delightful telephone calls from her mobile phone. The news of her engagement was received by her friends with either squeals of excitement or envious comments, which gave Robin equal pleasure. At lunchtime, she awarded herself an hour off, bought 3 bridal magazines and a packet of replacement biscuits, which put the petty cash box, a labelled shortbread tin, into her debt to the tune of 42 pence, and returned to the empty office, where she spent a happy 40 minutes examining bouquets and bridal gowns and tingling all over with excitement. When her self-appointed lunch hour was over, Robin washed and returned Mr. Crowdy's cups and tray and his biscuits. Noting how eagerly he attempted to detain her in conversation on her second appearance, his eyes wandering distractedly from her mouth to her breasts, she resolved to avoid him for the rest of the week. Still, Strike did not return. For want of anything else to do, Robin neatened the contents of her desk drawers, disposing of what she recognised as the accumulated waste of other temporaries, 2 squares of dusty milk chocolate, a bald emery board, and many pieces of paper carrying anonymous telephone numbers and doodles. There was a box of old-fashioned metal acro clips, which he had never come across before, and a considerable number of small, blank blue notebooks, which, though unmarked, had an air of officialdom. Robin, experienced in the world of offices, had the feeling that they might have been pinched from an institutional store cupboard. The office telephone rang occasionally. Her new boss seemed to be a person of many names. One man asked for Oggie, another for Monkey Boy, while a dry, clipped voice asked that Mr. Strike return Mr. Peter Gillespie's call as soon as possible. On each occasion, Robin contacted Strike's mobile phone and reached only his voicemail. She therefore left verbal messages, wrote down each caller's name and the number on a post-it note, took it to Strike's office and stuck it neatly on his desk. The pneumatic drill rumbled on and on outside. Around 2 o'clock, the ceiling began to creak as the occupant of the flat overhead became more active. Otherwise, Robin might have been alone in the whole building. Gradually solitude, coupled with the feeling of pure delight that threatened to burst her ribcage every time her eyes fell on the ring on her left hand, emboldened her. She began to clean and tidy the tiny room under her interim control. In spite of its general shabbiness and an overlying grubbiness, Robin soon discovered a firm organisational structure that pleased her own neat and orderly nature. The brown card folders, oddly old-fashioned in these days of neon plastic, lined up on the shelves behind her desk, were arranged in date order, each with a handwritten serial number on the spine. She opened one of them and saw that the acroclips had been used to secure loose leaves of paper into each file. Much of the material inside was in a deceptive, difficult-to-read hand. Perhaps this was how the police worked. Perhaps Strike was an ex-policeman. Robin discovered the stack of pink death threats to which Strike had alluded in the middle drawer of the filing cabinet, beside a slim sheaf of confidentiality agreements. She took one of these out and read it. A simple form, requesting that the signatory refrain from discussing, outside hours, any of the names or information that they might be privy to during their working day. Robin pondered for a moment, then carefully signed and dated one of the documents, carried it through to Strike's inner office, and placed it on his desk, so that he might add his name on the dotted line supplied. Taking this one-sided vow of secrecy gave her back to her some of the mystique, even glamour, that she had imagined lay beyond the engraved glass door, before it had flown open and Strike nearly bowled her down the stairwell. It was after placing the form on Strike's desk that she spotted the kit bag stuffed away in a corner behind the filing cabinet. The edge of his dirty shirt, an alarm clock and a soap bag peeked from between the open teeth of the bag zip. Robin closed the door between inner and outer offices, as though she had accidentally witnessed something embarrassing and private. She added together the dark-haired beauty fleeing the building that morning, Strike's various injuries, and what seemed, in retrospect, to have been a slightly delayed but determined pursuit. In her new and joyful condition of betrothal, Robin was disposed to feel desperately sorry for anyone with a less fortunate love life than her own. If desperate pity could describe the exquisite pleasure she actually felt at the thought of her own comparative paradise. At 5 o'clock, and in the continuing absence of her temporary boss, Robin decided that she was free to go home. She hummed to herself as she filled in her own timesheet, bursting into song as she buttoned up her trench coat. Then she locked up the office door, slid the spare key back through the letterbox, and proceeded, with some caution, back down the metal stairs, towards Matthew and home. Chapter 7. Strike had spent the early afternoon at the University of London Union Building, where, by dint of walking determinedly past reception with a slight scowl on his face, he'd gained the showers without being challenged or asked for a student card. He had then eaten a stale ham roll and a bar of chocolate in the cafe. After that, he had wandered, blank-eyed in his tiredness, smoking between cheap shops he had visited to buy. With Bristow's cash, the few necessities he needed now that bed and board were gone. Early evening found him holed up in an Italian restaurant, several large boxes propped up at the back, beside the bar, and spinning out his beer until he had half forgotten why he was killing time. It was nearly 8 before he returned to the office. This was the hour when he found London most lovable. The working day over, her pub windows were warm and jewel-like, her streets thrummed with life, and the indefatigable permanence of her aged buildings, softened by the streetlights, became strangely reassuring. "We have seen plenty like you," they seemed to murmur soothingly, as he limped along Oxford Street carrying the boxed-up camp bed. 7.5 million hearts were beating in close proximity in this heaving old city, and many, after all, would be aching far worse than his. Walking wearily past closing shops, while the heavens turned indigo above him, Strike found solace in vastness and anonymity. It was some feat to force the camp bed up the metal stairwell to the second floor, and by the time he reached the entrance bearing his name, the pain in the right end of his right leg was excruciating. He leaned for a moment, bearing all his weight on his left foot, panting against the glass door, watching it mist. "You fat cunt," he said aloud. "You knackered old dinosaur." Wiping the sweat off his forehead, he unlocked the door and heaved his various purchases over the threshold. In the inner office, he pushed his desk aside and set up the bed, unrolled a sleeping bag and filled his cheap kettle at the sink outside the glass door. His dinner was still in a pot noodle, which he had chosen because it reminded him of the fare he used to carry in his ration pack, some deep-rooted association between quickly heated and rehydrated food. And makeshift dwelling places had made him reach automatically for the thing. When the kettle had boiled, he added the water to the tub and ate the rehydrated pasta with a plastic fork he had taken from the ULU cafe, sitting in his office chair, looking down into the almost deserted street, the traffic rumbling past in the twilight at the end of the road, and listening to the determined thud of a bass from 2 floors below in the 12-bar cafe. He had slept in worse places. There had been the stone floor of a multi-storey car park in Angola, and the bombed-out metal factory where they had erected tents, and woken coughing up black soot in the mornings. And worst of all, the dank dormitory of the commune in Norfolk, to which his mother had dragged him and one of his half-sisters when they were 8 and 6 respectively. He remembered the comfortless ease of hospital beds in which he had lain for months, and various squats, also with his mother, and the freezing woods in which he had camped on army exercises. However basic and uninviting the camp bed looked lying under the one naked light bulb, it was luxurious compared with all of them. The act of shopping for what he needed and of setting up the bare necessities for himself had lulled Strike back into the familiar soldierly state of doing what needed to be done without question or complaint. He disposed of the pot noodle tub, turned on the lamp and sat himself down at the desk where Robin had spent most of the day. As he assembled the raw components of a new file, the hardback folder, the blank paper and an acro clip, the notebook in which he had recorded Bristow's interview, the pamphlet from the Tottenham, Bristow's card, he noticed the new tidiness of the drawers, the lack of dust on the computer monitor, the absence of empty cups and debris, and a faint smell of pledge. Mildly intrigued, he opened the petty cash tin and saw there, in Robin's neat, rounded writing, the note that he owed her 42 pence for chocolate biscuits. Strike pulled 40 of the pounds Bristow had given him from his wallet and deposited them in the tin. Then, as an afterthought, counted out 42 pence in coins and laid it on top. Next, with one of the biros Robin had assembled neatly in the top drawer, Strike began to write, fluently and rapidly, beginning with the date. The notes of Bristow's interview he tore out and attached separately to the file. The actions he had taken thus far, including calls to Anstis and to Wardle, were noted, their numbers preserved, but the details of his other friend, the provider of useful names and addresses, were not put on file. Finally, Strike gave his new case a serial number, which he wrote, along with the legend, Sudden Death, Lula Landry, on the spine, before stowing the file in its place at the far right of the shelf. Now, at last, he opened the envelope which, according to Bristow, contained those vital clues the police had missed. The lawyer's handwriting, neat and fluid, sloped backwards in densely written lines. As Bristow had promised, the contents dealt mostly with the actions of a man whom he had called the Runner. The Runner was a tall black man, whose face was concealed by a scarf, and who appeared on the footage of the camera on a late-night bus which ran from Islington toward the West End. He had boarded the bus around 50 minutes before Lula Landry had died. He was next seen on CCTV footage, taken in Mayfair, walking in the direction of Lula Landry's house, at 1:39 a.m. He had paused on camera and appeared to consult a piece of paper. Pos an address of directions, Bristow had added helpfully in his notes, before walking out of sight. Footage taken from the same CCTV camera shortly after showed the Runner sprinting back past the camera at 2:12 and out of sight. Second black man also running. Pos lookout? Disturbed in a car theft? Car alarm went off around the corner at this time, Bristow had written. Finally, there was CCTV footage of a black man closely resembling the Runner, walking along a road close to Gray's Inn Square, several miles away, later in the morning of Landry's death. Face still concealed, Bristow had written. Strike paused to rub his eyes, wincing because he had forgotten that one of them was bruised. He was now in that light-headed, twitchy state that signified true exhaustion. With a long, grunting sigh, he considered Bristow's notes, with one hairy fist holding a pen, ready to make his own annotations. Bristow might interpret the law with dispassion and objectivity in the office that had provided him with his smart engraved business card, but the contents of this envelope merely confirmed Strike's view that his client's personal life was dominated by an unjustifiable obsession. Whatever the origin of Bristow's preoccupation with the Runner, whether because he nursed a secret fear of that urban bogeyman, the criminal black male, or for some other, deeper, more personal reason, it was unthinkable that the police had not investigated the Runner and his possibly lookout, possibly car thief companion, and certain that they had good reason for excluding him from the suspicion. Yawning widely, Strike turned to the second page of Bristow's notes. At 1:04 to 5, Derek Wilson, the security guard on duty at the desk overnight, felt unwell and went into the back bathroom, where he remained for approximately a quarter of an hour. For 15 minutes prior to Lula's death, therefore, the lobby of her building was deserted, and anybody could have entered and exited without being seen. Wilson only came out of the bathroom after Lula fell, when he heard Tansy Bastigui screaming. This window of opportunity tallies exactly with the time the Runner would have reached 18 Kentigern Gardens if he passed the security camera on the junction of Elderbrook and Bellamy Roads at 1:39. And how, murmured Strike, massaging his forehead, did he see through the front door to know the guard was in the bog? I have spoken to Derek Wilson, who was happy to be interviewed. And I bet you paid him to do it, Strike thought, noting the security guard's telephone number beneath these concluding words. He laid down the pen with which he had been intending to add his own notes and clipped Bristow's jottings into the file. Then he turned off the desk lamp and limped out to pee in the toilet and on the landing. After brushing his teeth over the cracked basin, he locked the glass door, set his alarm clock and undressed. By the neon glow of the street lamp outside, Strike undid the straps of his prosthetic, easing it from the aching stump, removing the gel liner that had become an inadequate cushion against pain. He laid the false leg beside his recharging mobile phone, manoeuvred himself into a sleeping bag, and lay with his hands behind his head, staring up at the ceiling. Now, as he had feared, the leaden fatigue of the body was not enough to still the misfiring mind. The old infection was active again, tormenting him, dragging at him. What would she be doing now? Yesterday evening, in a parallel universe, he had lived in a beautiful apartment in a most desirable part of London, with a woman who made every man who laid eyes on her treat Strike with a kind of incredulous envy. Why don't you just move in with me? Oh, for God's sake, Bluey, doesn't it make sense? Why not? He had known, from the very first, that this was a mistake. They had tried it before, and each time it had been more calamitous than the last. We're engaged, for God's sake. Why won't you live with me? She had said things that were supposed to be proofs that, in the process of almost losing him forever, she had been as irrevocably changed as he had, with his 1.5 legs. I don't need a ring. Don't be ridiculous, Bluey. You need all your money for the new business. He closed his eyes. There could be no going back from this morning. She had lied once too often about something too serious. But he went over it all again, like a sum he had long since solved, afraid he had made some elementary mistake. Painstakingly, he added together the constantly shifting dates, the refusal to check with chemist or doctor, the fury with which she had countered any request for clarification, and then the sudden announcement that it was over, with never a shred of proof that it had ever been real. Along with every other suspicious circumstance, there was this hard-won knowledge of her mythomania, her need to provoke, to taunt, to test. Don't you dare fucking investigate me. Don't you dare treat me like some drugged-up squaddy. I'm not a fucking case to be solved. You're supposed to love me, and you won't take my word even on this. But the lies she told were woven into the fabric of her being, her life, so that to live with her and love her was to become slowly enmeshed by them, to wrestle her for the truth, to struggle to maintain a foothold on reality. How could it have happened that he, who from his most extreme youth had needed to investigate, to know for sure, to winkle the truth out of the smallest conundrums, could have fallen in love so hard and for so long with a girl who spun lies as easily as other women breathed? It's over, he told himself. It had to happen. But he had not wanted to tell Anstis, and he could not face telling anyone else. Not yet. There were friends all over London who could welcome him eagerly into their homes, who would throw open their guest rooms and their fridges, eager to condole and to help. The price of all those comfortable beds and home-cooked meals, however, would be to sit at kitchen tables, once the clean pyjama children were in bed, and relive the filthy final battle with Charlotte, submitting to the outraged sympathy and pity of his friends' girlfriends and wives. To this he preferred grim solitude, a pot noodle and a sleeping bag. He could still feel the missing foot, ripped from his leg 2.5 years before. It was there, under the sleeping bag. He could flex the vanished toes if he wanted to. Exhausted as Strike was, it took a while for him to fall asleep, but when he did, Charlotte wove in and out of every dream, gorgeous, vituperative, and haunted.